Everyone, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and today my guest is Tom Equals. Tom served as a combat pilot in Vietnam. He's an author and a horse whisperer. Tom's debut novel, The Horseman's Tale, isn't just another war story or equestrian adventure. It serves as a roadmap for anyone looking to break free from the corrals of their past and race towards a horizon of hope. And we're going to talk about the book, and we're going to talk a little bit about Tom's background in just a minute. But first, Tom, I'm really glad to have you here. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you very much, Scott. I'm honored to be here. Do a great job.
Thanks. Absolutely. And I'm grateful to have you here as well. Anytime I have, any kind of interactions with Vietnam era veterans, I always want to, welcome them home, because you guys did not get the proper welcome when you guys came home. So first off, welcome home.
And thank you very much.
And, I want to kind of dive into a little bit of your experiences just a bit here. Can you tell us about your time in Vietnam, what you did there and how that's later on influenced the work that you're doing now?
Sure. I'd be happy to. I'm probably one of the youngest Vietnam veterans that you're going to meet, because, I was 19 years old when I was in Vietnam, and that was in almost the entire year of 1972 and early 1973, which is when all the American troops were pulled out of Vietnam. January, there was a treaty, January 23rd, I think, of 1973. And within a month or two, everybody was gone. And my return home date, was in January anyway. So it worked out. But I went into the Army. I was a senior in high school, and a group of seniors, a young men, were asked to attend a meeting where three Army aviators did a presentation about the ability to go right from high school into flight school, become what's called a warrant officer, pilot, and learn how to fly. And it was initially focused on helicopters. And I think it's because the Vietnam War was a war where there was a rapid transition into an air mobile strategy, where the helicopter is one of the primary tools of moving troops around and providing close air support, things like that. So I went to flight school right out of high school. And that was a little bit over a year program, because we had to train as infantry soldiers first. I think that was a motivational thing for flight school, because if you flunked out of flight school, they like gave you an M16 and a rucksack and sent you immediately to Vietnam as an infantry soldier. So when I got out of flight school, I was at the top of my flight school class. So I think it was the top five students in the class were given the option to, instead of flying UEs, which were the utility helicopter used in Vietnam, to transition into either Cobra, the Cobra, which is a helicopter gunship, primarily used for close air support, things like that, or the Chinook, which is a big utility helicopter, or the Sikorsky flying crane. I mean, these were all very sophisticated, big helicopter. Everybody wanted to fly these things, and it was sort of an incentive for the students. I picked the Cobra because when I was a little boy, I dreamed of being able to fly P-51 Mustangs, and this was right after World War II, but by the time I was old enough to do anything about it, the P-51 was long gone, because we transitioned into the jet age. But the Cobra was sort of like the modern day at that time equivalent of that kind of a fighter aircraft. And also it occurred to me, if I was going to be in combat, being able to shoot back was very important. And maybe the most important consideration is the Cobra was the only one of all those helicopters that was air conditioned. But I'd heard Vietnam was hot. I had no idea how hot it was. Okay, there were times when it was very hot and humid, so that air conditioner really came in.
That That is interesting. And the way the mind of a, you know, late teens, you know, aged type of person is, I want to be able to shoot back. Someone's shooting at me, I want to shoot back. Okay. That definitely checks out. I think that sanity check passes. And I'm going to someplace that's hotter than hell, and I'm going to want to have some air conditioning to come along with me for the ride. When someone's shooting at me, I'm probably going to be sweating anyway. So yes, absolutely. We want some air conditioning.
Yeah, right? It sounds superficial, but it turned out to be, you know, a very important consideration.
Yeah. But I mean, both of those considerations I think are valid. I would not take anything away from you from, you know, making those kind of, you know, consideration or taking those things into consideration when choosing.
Anyway, when I graduated from the, I was sent to a sort of the Army's version of Top Gun. It was called Cobra Hall. And I spent like about 2 months there. And from there, went to Vietnam and was assigned to the 48th Assault Helicopter Company. I was like a junior co-pilot. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, but I served with them for several months, and then as the war was winding down, that unit came to Germany. I think left Vietnam, went to Germany, but I stayed on and spent a few more months with Air Cavalry Troop, which is very interesting. You know, flying the killer part of hunter killer teams. You've probably seen the movie, I think it's We Were Once Soldiers, mm-hmm. About the Adrang battle. And that was the first air cavalry, but that was one of the first uses of the air cavalry concept, you know, the ability to, you know, go into these areas behind enemy lines and, you know, drop troops in and, you know, take positions that you wouldn't be able to do if you had to travel by land.
Right. Right. Well, and that's, you know, interesting too, because, you know, like you said, that's like one of the first uses of this, you know, method of troop movement and things like that, where, you know, you get to be kind of part of military history in that respect, you know, and that's pretty cool too.
Yeah, some of the battles that we fought in 1972 are recorded as a part of military history, especially the Spring Offensive, which started, also called the Easter Offensive, the very first part of April of 1972. And I flew through that, and I got my first Distinguished Flying Cross during that period. Overall that year, I flew about 300 combat missions. Which to me felt like a lot, you know,
yeah.
But, you know, the problem with flying Cobras was that usually when you went someplace, it was, you know, because somebody was being shot at and you're trying to assist them or to shoot something. But in either event, you know, you knew that when you went on the mission, you were going to get shot at. So, you know, there was a tension there that was not really the same for somebody that's transporting VIPs, you know, from one place to another. There are a lot of helicopter functions that are relatively mundane, but Cobras were not. There was always some excitement during the course of a day.
Well, but I think anyway, that maybe go ahead. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I think that also speaks to the mind of a late teenager, you know, looking for a little bit of excitement as well is, you know, but I'm sure after that first dose of excitement, the novelty of it kind of wore off real quick.
Well, right? Trust me, you know, I went in there thinking that it was going to be a lot like these post-World War II aviator hero movies with John Wayne and this and that and the other. Like, but there was a point when I thought to myself, oh, what did I get myself into here?
Right.
I mean, it was like very dangerous and you know, we're getting shot and wounded and killed. And, you know, at some point the reality of all that settles in. I mean, you have to sort of suck it up and do your best, but it's a different kind of excitement from what you maybe anticipated.
That's right. Yeah.
So anyway, it, In 1973, as I mentioned, that's when that treaty was signed, pulling all the troops out of Vietnam. So there was a big reshuffling, and most pilots were let go. You know, they can go to the reserves of the National Guard or home. When you went through flight school, you had a 6-year commitment. So a lot of people that went to flight school were committed for an extended period of time, but those commitments were released. But I was asked to stay on, and I did. I was obligated to stay on anyway because I had a 6-year obligation. But, you know, I was asked to be an instructor pilot at the Army Aviation Center, which I agreed to do. And that was very good for me. I mean, my thought process then was I had this feeling that coming back from Vietnam, I wasn't really ready for civilian life. You know, my mindset and everything were they're probably a little bit hair trigger and what you're thinking about as you work to survive in a daily combat situation, doesn't always work well on the streets. And the Army didn't really provide any transition. It's like, you know, you show up and you're with your friends,
Yeah, right.
And then you're unemployed too. I used that opportunity to be in an environment that was in a structure that I understood and was comfortable with, which allowed me 4 years or so to decompress. And while serving as an instructor pilot and a TRADOC project officer, I also went and got my bachelor's degree and my master's degree at the university. It was near the fort, Troy University, and they actually set up a campus on the aviation center. So it was very easy for me to take pretty much a full academic load at night.
Well, and that is certainly good too, because I have to imagine, given your age coming out of Vietnam, and then transitioning into this instructor role, you were probably on the younger side of folks, in that school, not just talking the trainers, the faculty kind of, the instructors, but as far as the students who you're teaching, you're probably much younger than some of them as well, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So, having
and very often some of the students outranked me as well. So,
right. I could see that happening.
One of the things about Army pilots is that we, and pretty much I never saw anything where it was a problem. You know, regardless of what your rank was, if somebody was in charge, they were in charge of the aircraft, So,
yeah.
When I'm the instructor pilot, it could be a colonel in the aircraft, and I'm a chief warrant officer too. But if I say do something, he would do it,
Sure.
And
sure.
Not to say that there might not be a discussion, but if it's urgent, especially, you follow the instructions of the aircraft commander or the pilot in command or the instructor pilot.
And I think that makes sense too, when you have somebody who is more experienced in something, especially as dangerous as aviation can be. If you're flying up in the air and someone who's more experienced than you tells you to do something, you're not going to stop and question it. You're going to just do it, right? You don't want to.
And the warrant officer ranks, their pay, track the commissioned officer ranks. But warrant officers are technical specialist officers. And right. That's why a lot of pilots were, you were specialized as a pilot. So you might be paid the same as a lieutenant, as a young warrant officer. And the lieutenant technically outranks you. But at some point, as you move, especially as you move up and gain seniority, your expertise is the reason why you're there. So people defer to that often. And for example, the Army Aviation Center is named after Chief Warrant Officer 5, Michael Novosel. He was pilot in Vietnam, received a Congressional Medal of Honor. Those technical officers are given a lot of respect and deference in their field.
Yeah, for sure. And they should, because, you know, they are, like you said, they're the experts in that field. And, at that point, rank doesn't matter as much when you're coming down to that expertise. You have to rely on that expertise versus experience or, time in the service or that type of thing.
Usually in aviation companies and instructor pilot type situations, people get to know who you are and work with you. And so, your expertise also is a foundation for the respect. Your actual expertise is a foundation for the respect, not just because you have a set of wings on your chest.
Right. Exactly. I want to kind of fast forward a little bit here, kind of in the conversation. And I want to talk a little bit about your book. I mentioned in the intro, the book, the Horseman's Tale, which I have a copy here. Thank you again for sending me a copy of this book. But the Horseman's Tale, it's a fiction book, but it's grounded in some reality. It's not 100% made up, a false fiction narrative or anything. There's some real life scenarios that take place in the book, but it's not. It's not your story necessarily. It's, it is a fictional story, but the book talks about the impact of PTSD, especially on the main character of the book, Jake. Can you tell us a little bit about, the book and kind of how you kind of wove in some of the things from kind of real life into, the story?
Sure. I'd be happy to. And just to give a little bit of a background, My graduate and postgraduate work was heavily laden with courses in advanced psychology and different psychological, modes of therapy. So I'm very familiar with a lot of that. And at one point thought I might be a professor in that area, and I was specializing in individual offender rehabilitation. But then I realized, I also had a very strong drive to go to law school because I, wanted to be a lawyer. And I took that course ultimately and left some of the psychological expertise on the table. So I put a lot of that education to good use in this book. But this book is based on a fictional premise. Of course, I've had horses for all my life and have a horse farm here in Ocala for many, many years. And a lot of expertise in show horses and race horses. So I took a liberty. I've had some great horses over the years. Friends of mine will say, "Oh, I know that horse," there are fictional versions of horses that I've actually had. And I did that for fun. And
sure.
But the story itself, it is fictional, but like any good story, it's based on truth, some universal truths and some truths that I experienced during my year in combat. In the course of 300 combat missions, you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about others, the way people feel in close combat, whether you're a Marine, on the ground or a pilot in the air, those emotional aspects are very much the same. And you also have the opportunity to see how they affect other people. Mm-hmm. If you're observing your friends and it can have tremendous impacts on people psychologically. And that's where the PTSD comes from. So I was, I had a number of horse stories that I'd written over the years, short stories that were actually true stories. And you know, I'd been asked to, you know, you should put those into a novel. I just never really had an idea how to do that. But I was sitting alone one evening after work in my recliner watching The State of Hate on CNN, which was about the resurgence of, you know, white supremacist movements like the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazis. And I remembered from when I was young of the tremendous issues that were at play in the 1960s when the schools in Florida were desegregated. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of violence and so forth. And so I was watching it. It had me on edge a little bit because, you know, Florida has changed so much since the Civil Rights Act and opening up to society. And in fact, you know, like the town where I'm at, Ocala, has changed dramatically. We're one of the fastest growing cities in the country, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, all kinds of amenities, you know, big communities of people from the Northeast and the Midwest that have come down, you know, for an active post 55 year old retirement type scenario. So, you know, I've seen the changes and they're changes for the better. And so like I said, I was a little bit on edge because I think to myself, you know, how can people want to go back to, you know, you know, like lynching people and firebombing churches? And I mean, there was just a lot of stuff going on, right? There was bad stuff. And then this Camp Lejeune commercial comes on. It's a law firm commercial where the lawyers have a sort of a talking head is, you know, if you were stationed at Camp Lejeune and you suffer, you or anybody in your family suffered any of these things, you know, you have this right to file a claim. And even though I'm not a Marine and hadn't been to Camp Lejeune, a light bulb went on in my head that this was an opportunity to take somebody, because as I mentioned before we started the show, one of the things I thought is, what would it be like? You're sitting there watching this commercial, and for the first time, you know that this water contamination had been covered up for decades, and somebody in your family died because of it, or had birth defects, or you had some illness for years that you never knew why, and it was directly related to that. I mean, I thought you'd just explode. So that just like the character in the book, he sees this, and he had lost a son that was born at Camp Lejeune due to birth defects, and his wife had died in the not too distant past from liver cancer, which was another thing that they mentioned on the commercial. So he just explodes and throws his drink at the TV screen. He's all by himself, you know, and he realizes, you know, he's had a PTSD moment, but for the first time, he's able to tie it to a trigger, mm-hmm. you know, and he vows to sit down and not stop writing until he runs out of whiskey or words. And to some extent, when I had the idea, I said, I'm going to sit down and start writing. Like I'm in that, you know, I can feel this, you know, is a good foundation for the story. So I tried to build that character and allow, you know, my readers, I hope, to explore, you know, what it's like to have been a veteran who's been exposed to these stresses and to have experienced these tremendous losses. You know, what would it feel like? A part of this is like a psychological drama. It's about veterans. It's about war. It's about horses. But it's also, you know, where this protagonist, his name is Jake Montgomery, you know, has sort of a peeling of the psychological onion using this written exposure therapy, because he's writing this not so you can read it, or somebody in his family can read it. He's not telling a story to anybody about himself. Mm-hmm. You know, he's writing this for himself. This is for his eyes only. You know, that's the premise of written exposure therapy or journaling therapy. So, right. So you see the unvarnished truth, and it moves around because that's the way the mind works. So you probably, you know, in one of your, you know, literature classes that you have in high school and college, they talk about stream of consciousness writing. So in many respects, the flow of this book is set up like a stream of consciousness journaling, experience. But yeah, I believe it's all tied together very well, so it stays interesting. And
right.
And there are a lot of events, life events, that create drama, unexpected drama.
Yeah, and so, you know, through this journaling, like you said, it's a stream of consciousness. It kind of flows with the mind's thoughts and everything, and it gets the real unvarnished truth of what this person is feeling. And so, you know, it's helpful because I think so it's relatable too. You know, like there are people who likely have experienced very similar things and can kind of relate to where this character is coming from. Now the horseman's tale, right? So we're talking about horses and equestrian type things. There's, you know, equestrian therapy as well. From your point of view, tell us a little bit about that and how that all ties in.
Well, certainly. The protagonist in this book grows up on a horse park. So he's with horses, except when he's in Vietnam or, you know, during, you know, different military events. He's with horses all of his life. And the benefits of equestrian therapy at first are not, you know, clear to him because, you know, he's getting that gratis, you know, because of his relationship with these horses. But
right,
he's also autistic. One of the things that he's hidden for most of his life is he was diagnosed very early on with what at that point in time that they didn't have the word autistic or Asperger's. It was called infantile schizophrenia. Hmm. And so one of the things that create, you know, his PTSD is the twisting that occurred because his parents were committed using different techniques, but to hide this from others so that he wasn't labeled or stigmatized because they had other experiences in their family where in time the children were able to develop and function and even be very high functioning. So,
sure.
But like anything, if you're a child and your parents are saying, but let's say you're a child and you have a grandmother that's African American, but everybody appears to be white, and it's the 1950s, right? And they're saying, whatever you do, don't let anybody know if grandma is colored, right? You know, that's our secret. And well, now for that child, what is that telling that child? That's telling that child there's something wrong with you that you have to hide, right?
Right.
You know, similarly with the autism, you know, there's a sense of like an attack on your self-worth, perhaps feelings of inadequacy, you know, that have to go along with the fact you're hiding who you really are. So that's one of the things that's developed in this book. And because he has experienced this, you know, he makes a point of working with children locally with the equine therapy for children that are autistic or Down syndrome to give them the opportunity to have the benefits of that experience with horses. And if I, you know, not all of your listeners are probably familiar with why equine therapy works. So if I could take a minute to explain that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
So horses, especially, and there are some other animals that are like this too, dogs to some degree. And I ate for 17 years, half wolf, half German shepherd, where I saw it also at a very high level in her. But horses, almost across the board, have an extremely high empathetic IQ or capacity. And what I mean by empathy is that horses are able to feel what you're feeling. Not intellectually, they don't intellectualize it. You know, if you're nervous or you're afraid or you're depressed, they can feel that. You know, and sometimes they'll adopt it. Sometimes they'll respond to it with a little extra love and acceptance. Somehow, you know, that connection between a person and a horse, you know, has the ability, especially I've seen, you know, with my own eyes, with autistic children, where they've been in this may be a slang term rather than a medical term, like a freeze loop, where they're, you know, locked into, you know, certain, you know, maybe apraxia, maybe, you know, which is might be the inability to speak or facial, mm-hmm. you know, gestures being or muscular gestures being frozen or spasmatic. And the parents, that there's nothing that the parents can do about it. But, you know, then you see, you know, that child, when you help them get on the horse, you have to help them to get to know the horse and everything. And they get on the horse and it just disappears and they're smiling and you realize something special just happened. I've seen parents cry when they see that, yeah. You know, because they feel lost. You know, they don't know what to do. They love their child, but they just don't know what to do. And so when you see things like that happen, you realize that some of these old adages, you know, or old horse sayings are true. And one of them is the best thing for the inside of a person is the outside of a horse. So like I went riding this morning for an hour and it's a horse that I helped bring that horse into the world when he was born. So we've been together for 12 or 13 years. We're buddies. And, you know, I go out with him into the woods and ride, and I feel good. I think he feels good. And no matter what's going on in my life, it makes a difference for me. So horses can play a very important role in helping from a therapeutic standpoint. And the therapy for PTSD follows along the same line. Because a lot of the PTSD is you have all these fears, you could be ashamed of things, you could be ashamed that you didn't do something to help somebody who got killed or, you know, there's no hero out there that has never experienced cowardice. I mean, you know, where you say, oh, I can't do this. Oh my, you know, I'm going to get killed. You know, everyone has experienced that, you know. Now, I guess what makes you a hero is even though you're feeling that way, you know, your call to duty is, well, you know, I got to do this anyway, you know, mm-hmm. and follow through. But very, very few, people, you know, are like the TV heroes where they just, charge.
Yeah, right.
You know, when you're being shot at or you're in a fight or whatever it is, you know, and your life is on the line. I've never met anybody who said that, oh, that doesn't bother.
Yeah, there's a bit of the self-preservation aspect that gets filtered into that that whole equation, right? It's interesting, too. I've talked to some other people about equestrian therapy for PTSD and other things. But, you know, to your point of, you know, when that child who maybe is struggling with something and they get on that horse and it kind of seems like it almost melts away. You know, the horse will be able to kind of sense the things that are going on with the person, but the person can kind of see how the horse is reacting too. And if the horse isn't reacting the way a horse normally reacts, you know, in your mind anyways, that might be a reflection of yourself. Is that like the horse is picking up on something from you that maybe it doesn't like, and that's making that horse not be as horse-like as you might expect it to be, right?
Well, and let's say, I mean, I've seen this, so I know that there's a relationship. Now, I'm a bit of a scientist nerd, you know, so this is not what anybody could ever say is statistically valid. It's anecdotal, but I've seen people who are terrorized by horses. Everybody's trying to get them to ride the horse, you know, and it's just not going to happen, because if you're like that afraid, you know, the horse becomes afraid.
Mm-hmm.
The horse doesn't understand why you're that afraid, but they realize that if you're that afraid, we probably shouldn't be doing this.
Right. Well, there's something to be afraid of in the horse's mind. There's something to, they don't know what it is. They don't know what it's in themselves. And so they become afraid because it's like, well, there's clearly something wrong, right?
Well, you know, I mean, even as an old man, I'm 72 now, soon to be 73, I hope, you know, you realize that you're not immune from screaming out in fear, you know, when something surprises you. We have in the forest here in North Central Florida, we call it spider season. It's about a month and a half there when across the trails in the woods around here, these spiders like the size of your hand, we call them banana spiders. I don't know why, because there's no bananas in but they are yellow, and they make their webs, these big webs, across the trail.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if you're not paying attention, you know, and you run into one of those webs, the spiders, they just go up. You know, when they're afraid, they just go up. And we went through one. I didn't know it because it was sort of lower, and the spider came up the horse, got on me, came up me. I didn't know that there was a spider on me until it was like crawling on my face, you know? And I screamed like a little boy. It was like, the horse took off.
Oh, wow.
Especially, this is my horse. I mean, you know, I never probably experienced.
Yeah, sure.
And he figured.
Yeah, but at that point, the horse.
We don't want to be here anymore.
Right. The horse knew something was wrong. Didn't know what necessarily, but knew something was wrong. Right. It's interesting, you know, hearing about equestrian therapy. And obviously this episode is not 100% about equestrian therapy. It's not like you have equestrian therapy services that you're providing or anything like that necessarily.
No,
right.
Don't. But you know, all the equestrian type therapy activities that I've done over the years, and I have a lot of years of experience, have been, you know, like people have asked, you know, can I bring my child? And I always try to accommodate that. And
yeah,
and sure. There was one little girl, she had fairly high functioning autism, but she was in a special education section at her school, and her parents wanted to see if she could do some riding. They would bring her, you know, every weekend. And I had an older horse that was sort of retiring, and I used that, and they got along really well, and ultimately gave her the horse. But she, you know, her parents for years would come back and say thank you, you know, telling me the progress she'd made, because she's able to get into a normal academic program. She was showing the horse successfully, and there was just a big change in her personality based upon her relationship with that horse. So, you know, when you're able to do good things like that, you know, every once in a while, I think it's very important.
For sure. Yeah, absolutely. I kind of want to bring that back to the book though, again, the Horseman's Tale, and talk about how some of the characters, in the book, how the interaction with the animals, have kind of helped their progress, and how, that can, talked about how that can be applied in real life, obviously, you know, from a fictional story, but, you know, in real life that has its parallels as well, right?
Well, it does. And you know, the book is a very powerful, drama. It pulls you from page to page, partly because it's it's, you know, telling these experiences in a what I think is a fairly realistic way. You know, yeah. it feels like it's actually happening or has happened to somebody. But I want to, you know, rather than go to the specific characters and who did what, you know, remember, this is all first person from Jake Montgomery, sort of, you know, his journaling experience. But I want to talk about people in general.
Okay.
And veterans, you know, especially veterans who were actually in, you know, episodes of serious combat, you know, whether you're bombarded with artillery shells or, you know, crawling through the bush with a rifle or, you know, flying a jet fighter, you know, the you know, where their missiles being shot at you, you know,
yeah, sure.
Blowing up. I mean, you know, those people, I think, and to some extent, I experienced this myself, is you survive developing, think about it like an emotional shell, you know, a callus, where these things that hurt you kink inside. They, you know, the problem is that as you go through life, you know, that mechanism that you used when you're in these is a tremendously difficult combat situations becomes your go-to mechanism for dealing with problems oftentimes. And the result is if you have this emotional callus that you've developed to protect yourself, the reality is that the biggest thing that stands in your way to what I think is a path to happiness and love and relationships is that emotional callus. So it becomes the problem. Now, in this book, you know, we see how Jake Montgomery, you know, through his relationship with horses, and one horse in particular, a horse named Shiloh, that's a character in the book, you know, learns how to open himself up again. He opened himself to being able to love, you know, being able to care, not being ashamed of who he is or you know, how he thinks, you know. And with this horse, you know, he's experiencing a form of unconditional love that is healing for him. Now, what does that mean? That means that he now has the opportunity to interact in that same way with important people in his life. You know, this empathy that I'm talking about that we experience with a horse, you know, another very empathetic animal is the human being. You know? So, you know, but we don't approach each other that way. We don't, right. You know, kind of the societal, you know, strictures and the way we learn and process, you know, we develop the shell rather than learn how to be open and loving and accepting and forgiving. So this book is about how he learns, you know, to take all these things that he's hidden even from himself, you know, to take all the lies and rationalizations that are a part of that shell that everybody thinks is Jake Montgomery, break that down by accepting who he is and what he's done. And he's done some bad things in this book, you know, that are a part of, you know, what he hides from others and himself. And he learns to accept who he is. And then most importantly, forgive who he is. Because you cannot love if you cannot forgive. And forgiveness of others is almost impossible if you haven't learned how to forgive yourself for those things, you know. So self-acceptance and forgiveness becomes the foundation for him learning how to love again, for the restoration of his spirit.
Yeah. And when you look at that, that reaction that people have, that callousness that gets built up, sometimes it becomes easier and easier as time goes on just to continue building up that callus that hides those things from the rest of the world, and as opposed to chipping away at it and exposing some of those things. It's almost like a muscle that gets flexed over time. If you don't exercise that muscle, it's going to get weak and it's going to be harder to do anything with it. But, the more you use it, the easier it gets. And so the more you use that muscle of building up that callus, if you will, using that kind of as an analogy, the easier it is just to continue to have that callus built up there.
It's true. And perhaps the most important thing that we can learn in life, if we want to have a happy and rich life, is to learn how to love. And that may sound like a very Pollyanna kind of a thing, but the reality is that, we need to learn how to love ourselves and love others if we're going to have a happy life, mm-hmm. if we're going to have a satisfying life. And sometimes, because of that shell I described, and obviously it's a allegorical shell.
Yeah, sure.
But it can be very hard and tough, but nobody can see it, like visually. But because of that, we get very few opportunities with other people to break through that because, people have their own issues. So but all of us, if we have that problem, we'll have some mechanism. We'll have a cat or a dog if you think about it, you come home from work and your dog is overjoyed, that you're home. Well, that's love.
Yeah.
Well, and if we could just learn that lesson from the dog, or the horse, and start to apply it to our own lives where we express and receive that kind of a feeling with other people. And I believe we'll find that it creates an opportunity for a spiritual enrichment.
Yeah, because, maybe it's easier to express love towards an animal, a horse, a dog, other animals. And maybe that's why this is so effective, is because it works at chipping away that callus that we've had built up over all these years, potentially, where we're like, okay, well, yes, I can be this way towards this animal. Why not towards the other people in my life as well? Right.
Right. Well, and the reason that you see it where people can have this very tough emotional shell, but with a dog, they melt with it, their dog, right? Well, it's because, they don't feel like the dog is judging them.
Yeah, right.
They could tell the dog, I could have saved my buddy Bob when, we were being attacked by so-and-so, but instead, this mortar hit and I ducked down and by the time I, came out of my hole, he was dead. But I could have saved him and I regret it. Well, you could tell that to the dog. The dog could care less, right? The dog right. still loves, like I say, the dog still loves you. You come home, the dog loves you. He's happy. So maybe that's why, and not to say that people don't like, talk about these hidden things with their animals, but the animals, the horse is not judging you. The horse responds to you. The horse loves you. Sometimes if you're mean or cruel to a horse, the horse will respond in kind, mm-hmm. Probably there's some dogs. I guarantee you, if I'd been cruel or abusive with my wolf dog, I might not have a hand,
Right. Right.
That wolf part of her was it upped her emotional IQ and everything a lot. But you always knew there was a wolf there.
Sure. So sure.
But I think that's the difference. you know, much of the fear that is the reason we have that emotional callus is based upon where we're judging ourselves harshly. We're not able to accept who we are, what we've done, you know, the mistakes we've made in life, you know, the poor choices. But the reality is that we all have those things,
right?
You know, there's sexual content in this book, for example, and there's violence in this book, you know, and people said, well, why did you put that in the book? I told them, I said, you know, the reason that's in the book is because these are the kinds of things that we deal with in life. I mean, it's different for everybody, you know, exactly how it manifests itself, but our anger, our violence, our sexuality, our misplaced sexuality, breaches of trust and love are all a part of who we are. Virtually every person has had these experiences, but those are experiences that they ignore, they hide, they rationalize, that are a part of what has to be dealt with and in order to move to that next step, which is forgiving oneself and learning how to love again.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting because if you can get a dog or a horse or, you know, some other animal to look at you the way that they look at you when you walk through the door, like a dog, you know, I'm using that as an example because I have dogs myself, but you know, you could, you know, leave them home alone, you know, all day, and you come back at the end of the day and they are ecstatic to see you. And they nothing that you did while you're gone matters to them. That doesn't matter. You're here right now. And that's what matters to that
right.
dog.
And you moment, hit the right? key word is right now, you know?
Yeah. So, yeah.
You know, you've been gone all day. They probably would have liked to see you 4 hours earlier, you know? But,
sure.
But you know, they're not operating. Oh, he wasn't here at 3 o'clock. No, they're operating on, oh my God, there he is, you know, right now.
And I think that was my point is that it's right now. There the animals are able to be present in the moment. And I know, like, through various therapies, they talk about kind of grounding yourself and that mindfulness and all that, and trying to be more present in the moment, right? But to your point, you said earlier, the dog doesn't care what you did, or the horse or any other animal doesn't care what you did 10 years ago or 20 years or decades ago when you're in combat, you know, that your actions caused this to happen and that to happen and all that kind of stuff. The animals just don't care about that. That's not important to them. They care that you're here right now, and they care that you're happy to see them as much as they're happy to see you right now. And so, like, getting that mindset shift, that frame of mind now on the here and now, I think is a lot better place to be, right?
Well, absolutely. And it, you know, it's a parallel experience teaches us, you know, ways that we can, you know, live better.
Sure.
So I believe our relationships with animals, you know, are, you know, in addition to whatever the working relationship is, you know, are learning opportunities for us in how to interact and have relationships. You know, relationships with people are sometimes more complicated and so forth because of the nature of humanity. But people, I think, you know, are meant to have the spiritual capacity to love.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's a part of our intrinsic nature, just like anything else that we do. You know, I'm in my 70s, but I exercise every day as much as possible. So I have muscles. I mean, they're not big muscles, but you know, I'm relatively fit only because I exercise. Well, you know, that capacity to love is only going to survive and not atrophy and maybe even grow if you use it, if you learn how to use it as a part of your everyday life. You know, be the love, you know, make it as much of a part of your daily routine as, you know, going for a walk or playing pickleball or tennis or shooting some baskets or lifting weights. There are ways to do it too that are just as simple as exercising. They're love exercises. It's like in the course of a day, try every day to, you know, do some act of kindness or something compassionate that you've said, I'm going to do something like this today, and you'll find the opportunity to do it.
Right.
You know, if you think about it, if everybody did an act of loving compassion every day, we would be living in a different world right now.
I'm sure that is absolutely true. And to your point, little things,
not big things.
Yeah, right. And sure, if there's an opportunity to do a big thing, wonderful. Do that. But if it's all you have time or capacity for is a little thing, if everybody did that little thing, it would have a tremendous impact on the world. Yeah. But to your point of how you have to do the exercise to get the muscle, or, you know, play basketball and or go for a walk, or you have to be intentional. You don't just fall into the gym and just like, oh my gosh, these weights are in front of me and I'm using them. Like, it's not like an accident that those things happen. You have to have some intention. You got to put your gym shoes on, you know, your gym clothes, you get in the car, you drive to the gym, you do the exercise, you all of that stuff. There's some intention there around that. Just like to your point, you probably have to be pretty intentional, especially if you have that callus built up where you're keeping people out, you're not letting people in, and you're being very hardened against that loving muscle, if you will. You haven't been flexing that very, very frequently. You're going to have to be pretty intentional with that, right?
Well, and that's right. And you know, going back to the book, The Horseman's Tale, you know, when people hear it, they think, you know, some of them have said, is that like a tail that wags? I said, no, it's like the Canterbury Tales. And in fact, you know, there is an element of the Canterbury Tales that is built into the overarching theme of this book. And that is, in the Canterbury Tales, it was in Old English, so it's very difficult for some people to understand it because of the way it's written. It was the first work of fiction in English. And the reason it was fiction is because if he had said those things, like where he's trying to explain them from his own mouth, he probably would have been burned at the stake, right?
Right.
Because it's Chaucer. So he's using these characters that are talking about things that are, you know, very important in the society of those days. But that theme of that book was each of these people tell their tale. They're on a pilgrimage to Canterbury to find reconciliation and redemption. Right? So their stories are about, oh, this was what my life was like, and I just, you know, I did this, and, you know, that's why I need to go, you know, to Canterbury Cathedral to find redemption. And through the telling of it, you can see, you know, in the reactions and the other characters, you know, that just the telling of it begins the process of confession and reconciliation and redemption. Because if you're able to tell it to somebody else, now it's out there. Right?
Yeah.
Now, in this book, you know, he's only telling it to himself, but the book shows the evolution, you know, of in the telling and in the living, how as he learns these lessons, you know, he learns how to love.
Yeah.
He learns how to change his life and his approach.
You know, and I think that's maybe very important piece of it to take away is that, you know, first off, yes, it's a work of fiction, but it's done in a way that it allows us to start to maybe learn and understand a bit about ourselves through through reading this. Just like you were talking about how, you know, all those years ago, in the Canterbury Tales, they use fiction for a purpose like that. And I think that's, you know, some people maybe, they think, oh, well, it's fiction, so maybe that won't apply to me. Well, you know, it's fiction, but it done in the way that you described here, it does apply, you know, because you might be going through very similar themes anyways, maybe not the same exact scenarios. Maybe you don't have horses readily available to you and you don't have, you know, Vietnam, you know, combat experience. But you might have something similar, right? And so you can at least take the lessons learned from a story like this and start to say, well, how can I apply these to my own life, right?
Well, and that was one of the reasons I wrote the book. Is, you know, I tried to convey what I think are some universal truths that become a foundation for life lessons that help us to live a better life.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's wrapped up in a story, but very much like Chaucer with Canterbury Tales or St. John of the Cross with the Dark Knight, which were an early work of Spanish fiction that, and both Chaucer and St. John were persecuted for writing what they wrote. I mean, St. John was imprisoned and tortured for years because he wrote this poem called The Dark Knight, which of course made the poem famous and 100 years later made him a saint.
Right.
But the story, you know, teaches, and this goes back to Jesus. You know, most of what Jesus taught, he taught with stories. He didn't say, do this or you'll go to hell. Mm-hmm. He told a story about, well, there was a farmer and he said, not everybody's going to understand this story, but if you understand it, good for you, you know?
Sure,
well,
sure.
You know, we learn from these stories. You know, somebody will read about Jake Montgomery's experience in The Horseman's Tale. And you're right. You know, not everybody was a Marine Corps recon officer in Vietnam and in this horrible combat and everything. But almost everybody in their life has experienced some trauma, whether it be abuse or a car accident or, you know, some serious trauma that you know, does have PTSD elements that follow on. You know, everybody in life that's an adult, I assure you, everybody have things that they're ashamed of, that they wish they hadn't done,
yeah.
That they wish they'd done differently, and that they hide from themselves and others as if it never happened, you know, but it's always there, you know, eating at them, you know, and getting that out, like the Jake Montgomery does in this book, you know, helps him. And if people understand, even if it's only to yourself in a journal, you know, where you type it out and you explain it just for, and then you delete it. Mm-hmm. That act of doing that is going to have a therapeutic impact on you to help you have a better life, because you're learning, you're coming to your truth. You're accepting who you were, you know, maybe it's not who you are right now, but you're accepting who you were, and you're learning how to forgive yourself. And with that forgiveness comes love. We have to learn how to love ourselves sometimes. That's not the easiest thing to do always, because nobody knows us better than ourselves.
that can be a blessing and a curse sometimes.
That's right. <Yeah. laughs>
but you're right. You know, nobody knows us better than ourselves. But a lot of times we are our own worst critics, you know, our own worst enemy, because we are so hard on ourselves, because we do know all of those intimate details that maybe not everybody else knows, things that we're ashamed of, things that we're afraid of, things that we, we're not proud of. You know, there's plenty of things that I I bet you anybody, if you sit down and think about it, you could probably come up with a list of a dozen things easily that you are ashamed of or not proud of, or, you know, feel guilty about, or things along those lines, rather easily, if you sat down and actually thought about it. Right. And so, yeah, of course we're going to be harder on ourselves because we have those things in the back of our head and they're constantly playing there sometimes for some of us.
And, you know, you mentioned the now earlier. I mean, you know, they become a part of our now, but we need to, I think break things down a little bit to, you know, saying this is who I was.
Yeah.
You know, and that's a part of me right now, but this is who I was and this is who I am right now, you know, but also, this is who I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do I see, you know, what I would like to do, you know, once I've had the freedom to be open about who I was and who I am. Because you can't go forward, you know, to who you want to be, you know, unless you dealt with those other two, who I was and who I am.
Right. Well, I think this is, has been a great conversation, going through the book again, The Horseman's Tale. Here's the book, try to get my fingers out of the way for the folks who are watching this video. The Horseman's Tale, it's a great way of putting all of these things that we talked about today, you know, kind of wrapped up into one package that we can share with others and hopefully help others, through this book. So I want to take the time to thank you for joining us today, sharing your journey with us as a young pilot in Vietnam through the years and what got you to this point where you decided to write this book. I'm sure there's a lot of folks out there, who are listening to this right now who are going to benefit from this interaction. But also I want to encourage folks to get a copy of the book, The Horseman's Tale. I'll have a link in the show notes for anyone who is interested in getting a copy. I'll have a link there so you can get that copy for yourself. But Tom, I do want to thank you for taking the time to come on. Really do appreciate it.
Well, and Scott, thank you very much for giving me an opportunity to talk about the book and what the book means. And The Horseman's Tale is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any of the major book distributors, or we do have a website, thehorsemanstale.com, that you can go to. But I think you'll find it's a very good read, and I think you'll find it's a read that'll, you know, pluck at your heartstrings in places, or, you know, some parts will make you angry, you know, but it's a book that has very high readability and emotional content. So I hope you enjoy the ride.
I think many people will. As I told you, I started reading it, obviously before we started recording here, and I do enjoy the story, the way it flows, and it's not an incredibly difficult read either. For some folks who are out there, it's like I don't have time to read or anything. It's a good read, and I think you'll enjoy it. So definitely
you,
grab
Scott.
A copy, and I'll have, like I said, I'll have links to that in the show notes as well. So grab a copy and let us know what you think.
All right. All the best.
All right. Thanks so much.